From MyDomain.com, this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. I'm your host, Hillary Kerr, and today I'm talking with Cassandra Gray, the founder of the content and commerce beauty company Violet Gray. If you're a beauty junkie like me, it's a must-read and a must-shop, especially if you're interested in brilliantly curated luxury beauty products, which, let's be honest, who isn't? They have the most incredible contributors and industry experts weighing in on Hollywood's most covetable makeup, skincare, hair care, and more. Plus, there's also a store on Melrose Place in West Hollywood that is a literal jewel box of gorgeousness. Launched in 2012, Cassandra has created this unquestionably cool destination for beauty inspiration and shopping, and I'm truly such a fan. But of course, one doesn't wake up one morning and just become a mogul who's reimagining the way that people consume and shop for beauty products. No, that's a Hollywood fairy tale. Instead, the journey to Violet Gray took a lot of hard work and different twists and turns and reimagining, which is why I'm so glad to welcome Cassandra to the show to share her story. Now on Second Life, it's Cassandra Gray. So, Cassandra, as always with this podcast, I like to start at the beginning because I think that's a logical place to start. As a young woman, what did you want to be when you grew up?
As early as I can remember, I wanted to be like Beyonce. I wanted to be like a pop star.
No way.
Yeah. I wanted to sing.
I had no idea.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I can't sing. So. I didn't go anywhere. But yeah, I would sing all the time.
But you didn't actually pursue the singing, or did you?
Well, I thought that I would. I thought this was what I was meant to be. I just couldn't sing, and no one told me that until I was older. I mean, I was very young. I was like 6, 7, 8, 9.
Tell me about your first proper job, like something where someone was giving you a paycheck.
My first real job, I would say, where I was given some responsibility, mm-hmm. which was a place called Small Fries in San Francisco in Noe Valley, which is coincidentally actually where I was born. And it was a great little store. That's a great little neighborhood with lots of kids
there.
It's very charming. And the woman that owned it was called Carol Yenny, and she was like kind of a big shot Gap executive that then left and started her second life. and opened a children's store. That was her dream. And so she, really gave me a lot of responsibility. And I felt so honored because I knew this was her dream. And so she let me do the windows, which was very creative. And, you know, I've always sort of done things that were both creative and then also commercial or business-oriented, marketing. So, yeah, I did that. And then, you know, slowly worked my way up to manage the store, and then I started to do most of the buying, which was really fun. I remember loving sort of saying, I would like to have that and not that. I like to be a buyer versus a seller.
You liked curating.
Much better to be a buyer than a seller.
So you like curating at a very young age.
Yes, curating, editing.
What did you love about that job and what did you not love?
I love that she allowed me to continue to grow. She kept giving me new things and new challenges. And, you know, I think I had an ego and was competitive from a pretty early age. So it was, like, fun to prove myself in different ways. And for example, I found Beanie Babies before, like, that happened. And it turned into this huge thing where there was like lines out of the door to get the Beanie Babies.
I mean, it was like an actual shopping frenzy.
It was really, really nuts. And I always reference the Beanie Baby strategy when thinking about sales and scarcity and urgency and all that. Yeah, so that was fun. And then the worst part was, I was at the time 17 and I was living like on my own and going to high school and also working. And
my God.
So I think I sort of felt like that job was way more important than high school. So it was the sort of, you know, conflict there that I think made it really challenging.
So how long did you do that?
I guess about maybe 3 years.
And then what made you decide to leave?
I moved across town. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of hard to get there. And then I really wanted to work as a bartender, cocktail waitress almost. So I moved right next door to this place in San Francisco called the Cliff House. Not the Clift House, which is like the cool hip place, which later as a marketer I worked for, so it was kind of full circle. But the Cliff House was this tourist place that was right on the cliff. It's still there, but, has a lot of history. And basically tour buses just come all day long and drop, huge hordes of mostly Europeans and Japanese people to come
thirsty
in.
Tourists.
And I served those people.
Okay. I'm a high-volume business, I'm assuming.
Yes, it was a high-volume business. I made a lot of money. I think I honed in on my charm and conversational skills because the whole point of it is to get a tip. So in order to get a tip, you have to provide good service, which I wasn't terribly good at. So I had to hone in on the charm and stuff.
What did you do next in your career?
Always sort of like from when I was really young, money was about paying the rent. So work was about money to pay the rent. So this was sort of the mentality that I had. And it was like survival. And yes, it was great to find good work, but it was more about, okay, I need to pay the rent, so I have to make money. So it wasn't really like I had this big all these big ambitions about, how I was going to, be somebody. It was more about how was I going to pay the rent.
The day-to-day hustle.
The day-to-day hustle. And I'm still on the day-to-day hustle, by the way, 41 years later. I was entrepreneurial, and I was living in San Francisco. It was like a city of entrepreneurs. And, I always say it's like everyone there has a business plan, like everyone here has a script. I always say that, but it's true. It's
and everyone in New York has a modeling portfolio.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, my modeling it used portfolio. To be anyway.
Mm-hmm. So, I was always thinking about, I was like buying URLs, trademarks, and I was always thinking about ideas and writing business plans. And by that, I mean like 2 or 3 pages of like market opportunities. And I was really into this idea of like brands and like building brands, and my father was always like, "What does that mean?" Like,
that's so unusual because that wasn't a thing.
No, and I would constantly be saying, "I'm going to build this brand and this brand and this brand," and my father was like, he just didn't understand what that was. I think it's about sort of taking a lot of key distinct characteristics and telling a story with that, and that's what I was always thinking about and always obsessed and studying. Typography and like putting things together and iconography and really art and Warhol is sort of probably the biggest inspiration of branding and how do we create these identifiable stories out of context. And I was just like obsessed with that. So I was
that's just like your intellectual side hustle.
Like so obsessed with it and constantly making, mood boards. And like I just moved. So I was going through all this old stuff and I just have so many mood boards. Like I was a hoarder of swipe and I create these, color boards, which is like obviously pre-Instagram and Pinterest. So I definitely was drawn to people and also branding and marketing, I guess. I always studied human behavior and specifically consumer behavior and specifically in the art category and studied sort of how the art market worked, which I think is, from my perspective, is probably the best study of branding. Like you could learn the most from the art market, fine art market. And then kids, like all the kids stuff I've studied too, like Winnie the Pooh and all. And it's so incredible because the child's brain is very specific. And while we evolve as a human species, children are sort of into the same things. before they are introduced to phones and stuff. So and I have a 2.5-year-old now, so it's really interesting to watch him towards brands that somehow he's been exposed to through these, you know, wild advertisers like me that are constantly trying to plant things in your head. So I was really into human behavior and art that influences human behavior. And so I think I was from that sort of age, early 20s, I knew I wanted to start a company, and I knew I wanted to be – to have an artistic point of view, and I knew that I wanted to figure out sort of art and commerce or the commercial way to monetize art. So I started my career in marketing really with real estate agents. So at the time in San Francisco, real estate agents were hot. Like they were, you know, Ivy League graduates, like very competitive because there was so much money in real estate because there was just like all these young people with so much money from .com. And, you know, there would be like 13 bids average on houses and apartments. And so they were really sophisticated people, yet they didn't have – they weren't differentiated from a branding perspective. And the way that they marketed themselves was like with these flyers, which they still have, and
like
business
stops.
Cards and bus stops and and email – at the time, email was just happening, email marketing. So I had this idea of like, okay, I'm going to take this group because I knew one and one was looking for an assistant. And I was like, okay, I don't know how to be an assistant, but what? How could I help this person? And so then I started to sort of study this world. And it was like quick. It wasn't like I was like methodical about it. It was just like, oh, I see an opportunity. How could I help and make money in this way? So then I started working with them to help brand them. So to differentiate them from their competitors, because it was all kind of a relationship business.
So what kind of stuff would you do?
So I like did their photography and their fonts and their email marketing and, you know, campaigns around email marketing and how to organize their who they were going to their network. So, you know, it's all built on relationships. So they constantly have to build new relationships and it's all built, you know, the good ones built on referral. So I worked on that. And they like at first they wouldn't pay me because I didn't, you know, like I was like a kid with no experience, but I had a lot of passion. So I got my real estate license and I said, well, just give me a very small percentage of your sales and I'll do all of this. So that ended up working, and so as a result I made a lot of money for a kid that age.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And then I kind of parlayed that into what I called like non-traditional PR, because I basically built a huge network of relationships with the real estate agents, but then all of their clients, which was like the young
who's who
people that could like buy a house or an apartment. And then I started working with like hotels and restaurants to help sort of populate them with the right kinds of people.
This is in San Francisco.
Yeah.
That was not a real industry then. I mean, now it's a known thing.
It was like influencer marketing before it was influencer marketing.
That's amazing.
And like word of mouth and, you know, like Tipping Point, Malcolm Gladwell stuff.
So what were some of the, you said hotels?
Yeah, so the Clift Hotel.
Yeah.
Not the Cliff House, but the Clift Hotel was one of my clients in the Ian Traeger group.
How did you approach them? You just were like, knock, knock, hey, I think that you don't have the right mix here and I can fix that?
It kind of, but I was also kind of like a party girl at this point. So I sort of, and San Francisco is a small town.
7x7.
7x7, exactly. So I sort of knew a lot of these people already and kind of started with sort of like, let's do an event or a party or something along those lines and get people there. And then I would make more proposals that would offer more.
How did you know what to charge?
I didn't really know what to charge, and I'm sure I didn't charge enough. But like, I was so excited that anyone would pay me anything ever. So,
and also, I'm sorry, like when you're in your early 20s, if someone's paying you to throw a party,
yeah, and they would.
That's fabulous.
I would have a charge account at all these fabulous places, and basically, my job was to bring fabulous people and like make sure they had dinner and
and have a fabulous time.
And like, it was so fun.
That's amazing.
It was really sort of like paycheck to paycheck, hustle to hustle. And I was just so excited to make money and work for myself and not have to go to an office.
So how did you get to New York from there?
So the first time I went to New York, I was like, oh, okay, I have to live in New York. Like, I just, it was like my whole life after that was like, how do I get to New York? I was just so inspired and so energized and, you know, just like the sex appeal and the, you know, irreverence and the energy was just like so exciting. So one of the hotels I was working with, I got a job with. And then when I got to New York, I just got other clients. And I got to, you know, I was able to learn a lot because I was exposed to a lot of different types of teams. And the whole time that I was doing this, I was A, having like a lot of fun in New York in my 20s and, you know, in love. I was doing it, but I was also constantly thinking about businesses that I was going to start and writing business plans and like meeting with people. And at that time in New York, that's when I wrote the business plan for Violet Grey.
That's crazy that it went all the way back. So what was the sort of seed in New York where, so you're essentially a creative consultant.
Yeah.
And an influencer marketer and hustling.
Party girl.
And too. Party. I mean, yeah. But like, P.S., I was in New York at the same time because I was working for Elle Magazine. Mm-hmm. And we're talking like early aughts, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was a fabulous time to be in New York and to go out in New York.
I loved it.
It was a really magical time.
And one of my clients was this arts club called Norwood.
Yes.
Which was... You've been there, yeah. I haven't been there in such a long time, but it was such an incredible place.
Can you explain it for people who not the two of us?
So it was on 14th Street. So the whole time I was living in New York before I was married, I never even went above 14th Street. So that was like the hot place to be. And it was these two guys from London that used to work at a place called Black's, which was like a literary private club. Obviously, private clubs are very popular in London. So they had a really cool one called Black's that was really for writers, and I loved it. And they were moving to New York to open this place that they didn't have a name yet, but they wanted to open an arts club, which was like a Soho House concept, except they, you know, they really wanted artists. And we characterized artists as artists, like painters and photographers and sculptors and all that, but then also architects and actors and writers and, you know, chefs, like anyone that was sort of expressing themselves.
Creatives
is a better word. So they found this brownstone that was really special. It was about five floors, and so each floor was something different. So the idea was that if you're an artist, a lot of artists don't have offices or don't have a place to have meetings or don't have a place to go and write or whatever. So my job was to find all the artists, to buy the member. Like, you had to pay for it. It was a paid thing. So I also had to get them to write a check. But it was so fun because at that time in New York, it was just, as you said, a really exciting time to be in New York. And I literally just got to go to people's studios and houses and, like, find people and read about people in magazines and, like, identify them and figure out how to get to them and go and meet them and, like, sell them on this, like, utopia place. In that I would create these dinners with 16 people from all different walks of creative life. So it was based on sort of the net-a-porter business model, so absolutely digital. The business plan was just literally content and commerce in the digital space.
In beauty.
In beauty.
Because also, just to point out to some of our listeners who might not be as Net-a-Porter crazed as the two of us, while Net-a-Porter has beauty now, that's a relatively new development. There was nothing in the beauty space at all.
There was nothing in the beauty space, and I had never worked in the beauty space. I was certainly a consumer of beauty and was going to the department stores to buy beauty and found that experience to be awful and unpleasant and inconvenient. So it just felt like this idea that people were ripping articles out of magazines like Sarah Brown wrote or something, and schlepping at the time I was in New York to sort of like Barney's or Bergdorf's and saying I want this, that just seemed like a problem that we could solve.
Footnote, Sarah Brown was the beauty director at Vogue, just saying.
Yes, 14 years.
You knew that you wanted it to be digital. Did you know that you wanted a brick and mortar? Was that part of it too?
Later it was a part of it, but not in the beginning, like just when it was a business plan. And what I learned writing that was that the market was huge. And, you know, I knew I was going to start a company. I knew it needed to have an artistic point of view and be branded and have an aesthetic and a look and all of that. So I think that, you know, beauty was particularly interesting to me because it was so emotional and so broad. And beauty is, you know, it's about sex, it's about attitude, it's not, it obviously has a lot of fashion, but also utilitarian. And so it's about hope. Yeah. And it's, it really, there's just communities and cultures completely dedicated to it and the pursuit of, I guess, feeling comfortable in one's skin.
So, and it's a reoccurring purchase.
And even if you don't like it, you don't return it.
No.
So from a business perspective, this is very good. Yeah, I mean, I thought a lot about beauty as the self-esteem business, but also fashion and also power. And it was like literally just finding inspiration from everywhere, from you know, images that I'd collected since I was a kid to, I mean, I love women and I love sort of the quiet vulnerability that makes us fall in love with women, and often like a secret quiet vulnerability, and actresses and movie stars often have this quality, and trying to sort of like capture that in any way, it could be a lifetime pursuit. So that was sort of the artistic point of view for Violet Grey, gathering all those kinds of images or language. Like there's a lot of like Fellini and Capote references and the beginnings of Violet Grey and the point of view and sort of like all the lost glamour that I could find within Hollywood. With, you know, at the time I was like digging through like Sue Minger's closet and Bob Evans, who's still around, who like lives in a, you know, lost Hollywood glamour house. And, you know, my husband at the time was running Paramount Pictures. So I got to go into those archives and I did the same thing at Warner Brothers. So I just like dove into like Los Angeles culture, but also the current sort of community of makeup artists, hairstylists, all the image makers that, you know, throughout the history of Hollywood were responsible for a lot of the images that I was inspired by and that have, you know, influenced so many campaigns and, you know, fashion collections. And so, like, Violet Grey was like, oh, we're going to celebrate the artists and the artistry that's, like, often displayed on the most famous places in the world. So, like, studying all of that and learning about that. And I as a sort of business entrepreneur person, I was always thinking about building brands with culture and community and how important that was. And it's hard to do and it has to be authentic and you can't, like, do it overnight. You have to sort of actually build that history. So the studio, this sort of salon, I like to call it, on Melrose Place, which is in the same building that our store is now in, was a little apartment that was built by John Wolfe and was like sort of, you know, Hollywood Regency. And it just had so much history and that lost glamour or whatever. So I just filled it with furniture that, you know, makes people trust you and, like, just tons of swipe. And then I was working with this girl who I found, who I loved, who was, like, selling vintage out of her apartment, Rona. And I started, like, building a brand around her and the space, which actually was, like, really self-serving because it brought so many cool people because they were, like, there to get vintage was, like, gold or, yeah, you know, drugs or something. And so that's kind of what built the or what was the sort of beginning culture of that little place. And it was really like a place that we could develop relationships. And so that's where I developed the relationships with the makeup artists and the hairstylists and the agents and the industry, the beauty industry here, and became a credible member of that industry because I knew I wouldn't be able to build Violet Grey unless I was, you know, had the authority to do that.
In the know.
In the know, in the relationships. I mean,
but
and
at this point, you have now tried and tested. You did that in San Francisco. You did that in New York. So to conquer LA was probably just a matter of time.
Yeah, I never thought about that. But yes, I mean, I guess curating a culture and a community of people is
kind of your
thing. Like a thread. Yeah. So that's what that place was, and it was great. It was so fun, and I loved going there.
I went. It was – I just remember it being this, like, really magical, by-appointment-only place for inspiration.
Oh, thank you.
And I just thought it was the coolest.
It was the coolest. It was fun. I mean, and it was a great, like, sort of lost leader to the beginning of Violet Grey and really was, I think, probably helpful when raising money because I had that – that was sort of a natural transition.
Well, you had, like, proven taste. And I think that's something – and proven vision. And that's something that even if you don't necessarily have, like, a distinct product yet, if you – if people know sort of what your stock is, then it's easier to invest in that in a way.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think I've been reading so much about all this, like, you know, I'm obsessed with marketing and influencer marketing now. And social media is just so fun and so cool. And – so there's just been so many overwhelming messages that credibility now trumps celebrity. So authenticity is more important than ever, and like actually doing the work, and this idea that, you know, you have to earn trust, which is true. And so I think that that allowed me to have more credibility because I actually did the work in the industry.
So I'm interested as someone who had been self-employed her entire adult life and who had – you had gone around and, like, made something out of nothing and, you know, kept moving forward and working – you worked with all of these different teams and you built a career, but you ultimately were sort of like your own operator in a lot of ways. How have you found it going from just being responsible for yourself essentially to then creating a team and a culture – in a community at Violet Grey? Do you like going to the same place every day? Do you like having – being responsible for how many people are on your team now?
I mean, I think my dream was always to have a team.
Because of the stability of it?
No, I just – when I thought, like, let's build a company or I want to build a company, I think of companies as people. And I think of great companies as collections of great people. And I
more
wanted –
more people curation.
Yes. And I wanted to be able to get to work with people that I thought were talented and smarter than me and inspiring. And I thought the only way I would be able to get to work with those people is if I started something because how I didn't know how I was going to get hired to work with those people. It was like I wanted to build a company with an artistic point of view that attracted – the kinds of people that I wanted to get to work with. And I also had all this time to really hone in on the point of view. And so there was so much authenticity and weight to all that DNA. And I took so much stuff from Hollywood and cinema that people are already emotionally, very emotionally connected to. So it was when they saw – when people saw my brand books or references to what I wanted to do, they just got, like, so emotional. So it really helped that I had that time to really build that. So I always recommend to, like, people starting out when they want to build something to, like, to take the time. Maybe you don't have as much time as I had, but even if you take, like, a month or 2 months to really get the vision on paper through, like, visual references and language, because that is a tool that I use to this day for recruiting or to get anyone on my train. You know, like, you have to figure out how to get them to work with you. You have to have, you know, you obviously you can sell it yourself and articulate yourself with language, but visuals are just incredible. In the beginning, it was pretty easy to attract really incredible people. And I also was at in LA in a time where it was just becoming hot to move to LA. So it was easy to attract people, not easy to keep people, and not easy to organize people to work really well together.
The nuts and bolts of it are complicated.
Yeah, really hard. And as you said, for me, I was like working for myself and working, and I kind of like plugged into teams and would kind of come and give my ideas and then be able to leave. And, you know,
like, you were the guest star.
A guest star.
Where you're like, hi, I'm fabulous. Yeah. Here are my fabulous ideas.
And everyone loves,
leave.
And everyone loves you. And I love everybody. And like, you know, you're not in the trenches.
And now you live in the trenches.
I live in the trenches. And I think we've been through probably, you know, most stereotypical wartime startup stuff, hurdles, and gotten through it because of people. So the hardest part of my job is definitely people, and the best part of my job is definitely people.
What is a big mistake that you've made, and how did you get past it?
I mean, I think probably the biggest mistake specific to building a company that I've made is taking culture for granted. Like, so we had a really incredible utopic culture in the beginning, just authentically, right? Because they were just like people sitting around. You could all fit in the same room. You're like, you've got a big vision.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You want to build. You've got these different problems to solve and hurdles to get through, but it's really clear.
And everyone's a team.
And a team. It's so incredible. And it's like you're all
wide-eyed. And you attract a very specific sort of person,
you know,
in those
been
early
through
days.
Anything yet. And so that was just incredible. And you know, so as a result, we didn't put a lot of emphasis or organize culture methodically, and we paid for it pretty hardcore and really lost a lot of key people in a time that we did not want to lose key people. And you might not survive kind of time.
But it's that stuff that, like, knocks you that you really learn from. I don't know about you. I wish I was the sort of person who didn't require mistakes to learn, where I could just look at it. I was like, oh, that pan is hot. I don't need to touch it. But I'm the sort of person who seems to need to touch it to really learn and then get burned. I was like, drat. But it's
also so much cooler to go through stuff. Like struggle and pain and hurdles.
It makes you understand your own fortitude.
It does.
And that's valuable.
Yeah. And as you just said, you learn the most from your mistakes. There's something like the wise learn from their mistakes and the wiser learn from the wise, which is good. Like, you could learn from other people's mistakes, which we'll talk about mistakes today, and hopefully somebody will learn something not to do. I've never learned more than like falling on my face and having to pick myself back up and figure it out.
So what are you most proud of right now?
I mean, I'm most proud of being a mother. Looking at him and the way that people react to him and the way that he has this like toddler empathy and the way that he's gotten through the stuff that he's gotten through. And it's just, you know, so that's definitely what I'm most proud of. With work, I mean, I'm most proud of, surviving and continuing to reinvent what we're doing at Violet Grey. And, you know, right now we're very focused on culture. I'm personally mostly focused on culture and people and installing this kind of day one Bezos culture that is very much about what we had in the beginning and really sort of like sky's the limit. We can do anything, not making decisions based on fear. So I'm really most proud of the people that I've been able to attract to work with me and the people that I've been able to get to work with and the people that we continue to attract to work with us.
I read somewhere that you have like a 12-book syllabus of books that you suggest, I suppose, that your employees read when they start, which I thought is the coolest thing I'd ever heard. I know, like, on the show Girls, Jenny and Lena had a syllabus of everyone who was a writer had to read, like, The Best of Everything and, you know, like, Having It All by Helen Gurley Brown and a couple of other books. And I just thought that was so cool to, like, get into a frame, a mental framework. What are some of the books that are on your Violet Gray syllabus?
This is a pretty new book, so it wasn't in the beginning, but it's called The Hard Things About Hard Things. Have you read that? It's amazing. And I, you know, I haven't found a lot of books helpful in that category in terms of learning how to be a CEO or a good manager. That one is really good for entrepreneurs. It's called The Hard Things About Hard Things by Ben Horowitz. And then in that sort of same realm, there's a, you know, Coach Wooden has, there's a lot of books that he's written, and then there's a lot of books that have been written about him. And his whole philosophy is just like, it's all the little things that make big things happen. And, you know, so we read a lot of those books, and they're on the list. And then there's a book about Hollywood called Indecent Exposure that is really fun to read if you haven't read it. And there's a lot of Hollywood and what we do. And then the Marlena Dietrich's ABCs is really charming and amazing. Secret Life of Salvador Dali by Salvador Dali, all about, in my opinion, ambition. George Lewis, Damn Good Advice. I mean, we have all those books, but Damn Good Advice is an easy one to give to people. Breakfast at Tiffany's is just like perfect. Every word is perfect. Decoded, Jay-Z's, that's great. And then Edie, which is a George Plimpton oral biography. It's really about New York in the 60s. There's like a lot of references in that time in the point of view for Violet Gray. The Inner Game of Tennis, which is, you know, I'm a previous life poker player and chess player. So there's a lot of that in business and I guess managing people and reading people and collecting people. And then Go Dog Go, which is like the first book I've ever read. But it's really, I don't know if you've read that recently with your kid. But
yes.
It's so charming. Like, do you like my hat? And it's just so incredible. The book is genius, that book. It's like you're smiling right now. Like all these things are stolen, but they're like tricks to, you know, emotionally connect people to who you are and what you're doing, which is what you constantly have to do as you're recruiting people to work with you.
I'm smiling because I love the idea and because I'm a book nerd, so it makes me really, really happy.
Yeah.
I think it's a great idea. Okay, last question. Yeah. If you could go back to talk to 19-year-old you, what advice would you give her?
I think that there's a lot of my dreams in life have come true, but I think the ones that haven't have been just driven by fear and, you know, not feeling like you could take the risk. And I've certainly taken a lot of risks, so I feel pretty good. But I constantly want to be taking more risks, too. So I guess I would say take risks. Take more risks.
That's good advice.
Yeah.
Cassandra Gray, thank you so much. That was Violet Gray founder Cassandra Gray. Thank you all for listening to this episode of Second Life. For more interviews with inspiring women like Cassandra, check out mydomain.com. As always, we'd like to know who you want to hear from on this show, so feel free to shoot us an email at secondlife@mydomain.com, or you can just DM me on Instagram @HillaryKerr. If you like today's show, please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to rate and review us. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life by mydomain.com.